Hello, I'm Michael Eads, and you're listening to a special edition of We Own This Town. This volume of the podcast features the members of Apollo Up sitting down to discuss the creation of their record, Chariots of Fire. Originally released in 2006, the album has been remastered and reissued on vinyl for the first time, 10 years later. I asked the band to sit down with Ryan Irvin of the Carter administration to discuss the writing, recording, and original release of the record. Full disclosure, my label, YK Records, released the reissue, and I'm a giant fan of the band and the album, obviously. This is part one of two that covers the inception of the record and every song from side A. Many thanks to Ryan for hosting the band, Jeremy Ferguson for lending his studio battle tapes to record it, and of course the band for indulging me in this behind the music style request. Thanks. Enjoy.
Where's that whiskey?
Are we starting now?
Yeah, let's start.
Yeah, let's
Are
start.
We recording already?
Oh yeah,
it's been recording.
This is just like the WTF podcast.
Oh man, go.
All right,
hot and ready with a follow up.
Hello. I'm Ryan Irvin, friend of and fan of the band, Apollo Up, and I'm sitting down with their members to discuss the 10-year anniversary release on vinyl of their album, Chariots of Fire. So guys, would you go around and introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Jay. I played guitar and sang on that record.
I'm Mike. I played bass and sang on the record.
I'm Jeremy, and I played drums, and it says that I sang on the record.
Okay, so I'd like to start, 2003, January, you released Demonstration Recordings.
If you say and then, so.
Yes,
no, that's true.
Yes, sounds about right.
Absolutely correct.
And January of 04, you released Like the End, Burn It Through.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that whole year was spent working on that record.
And, writing it, yeah.
Yeah.
So then, let's start, after that record's released, you're done with it, you're mm-hmm. starting this record.
Mm-hmm.
What's the, like... Is there a concept? Do you just have songs, or do you not have songs, or
I think
start
it,
there?
We just had songs.
Yeah,
mostly.
Yeah, we had songs. We had 8 songs, right?
I think we.
By the time we recorded, yeah,
there were. I remember, you know, like
no.
a couple that were.
No, we had 7 songs.
There were a couple that were written after we knew we were going to record.
Yeah.
Right.
Walking the Plank.
So
Plains, yeah. Tennessee. Were all 3.
After we had like booked
very late.
Dates.
Yeah.
But like, as far as just like
we had already recorded that other stuff.
That's right.
Because that's why we had to go to Alex the Great.
Yeah.
By the time Like the End had come out in January, we had I think already written Invisible Syllable, Situation Hot, and Cut Up. I think.
Mm-hmm. That sounds right.
Because we played that show at the Ackland House in like February of 2004, and we played all those
Ackland Palooza.
Ackland Palooza. Yeah.
Yep. That's right.
In that basement where we found out later that the water dripping on Jeremy was coming from the bathroom upstairs.
That was real bad.
Actual poo-poo.
You couldn't tell by the smell?
Oh, yeah. No, I knew what was going on. It was real bad. I probably had my shirt off. There's a video of it. And I just remember looking at Mike just kind of like wincing and screaming. That
Yeah. I was distracted because I had looked up and seen Lou Barlow.
Yeah, Lou Barlow was sitting on a washing machine in the basement of that house.
And as soon as we started playing, he walked up.
Yeah, I looked and saw him, and I was like, cool, Lou Barlow's going to watch us play. And I looked down, I looked up, and he was gone.
So you felt really good about the new songs.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had, because we played at that show, we played Cut Up and Situation Hot. I think we had decided not to work on Invisible Syllable at that point.
Yeah.
So you guys had the songs and you knew that you were going to record here again?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just automatically knew
that.
And
we did a demo of those songs here.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I found that, I came upon that CD the other day. And
That was Labor Day.
Yeah.
Was that Labor Day 2004?
Man, I don't know.
Yeah, we did a full set of demos for I guess, 7 of the songs. Plans, Tennessee, or...
And it was...
Walking
yeah.
the Plank.
And it was a done deal that Aaron Hartley was going to put the record out whenever we
mm-hmm.
finished it. I know that much.
Alternate version of Even If You Don't Know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Automatic Request.
Automatic Request. It was an archive of compromises. Cross-reference with debts. Who notes and regrets. A history of none the wiser. There's evidence here of accelerant fear. A half-empty hook of matches. No suspects, I fear, but the motive is clear. Automatic request, we are here to serve. If someone's buried in there that you can't hide, paranoiac digest, we've got grains of thick skull. Don't be fooled by the dust on the bureau. So
we had a handful of songs. We knew we were going to start recording. We knew we were going to do it here, and we knew Aaron Hartley was going to put it out on Theory 8.
So I think we demoed those songs September of 2004, and then kept working on them, came back and recorded May of 2005. So at that point, we had 7 new songs, plus a sort of a funky remake of Distance Difference.
Yes.
Oh, was that going to... That was
going to
go on the record?
Yeah.
That was just going to be the 8. It was just going to be those 8.
It was going to be an 8 song.
So is that just something you recorded that didn't make it on the record?
Yeah.
So it exists.
Oh,
it
exists.
It's somewhere.
Is there a reason why it's...
It's amazing.
So
because it's amazing. Because it's so amazing, if we put this thing out, people would be like, oh, we're just going to stop playing music because this is it. Yeah.
So like after we finished writing the songs for Light the End and had started writing the next batch of songs, we had been rehearsing the whole time at my house. Sarah and I lived over on Dozier Place, right behind the car wash over there, behind Mickey's. And then we moved into a little apartment. So we were like, the next like year and a half was all different rehearsal spaces. So like the next place we went after that,
God,
I think...
Was
we went into the spare room at...
Over in Green Hills.
We practiced at April and Lisa's house.
For like 3 times, and it was perfect. It was this little shotgun...
It's awesome.
Little shotgun room with like drop ceilings and...
Wood paneling.
Like
wood paneling, but it's kind of a long room.
Flush floors. Like the room was narrow as fuck. Yeah. Like we
sounded great in there.
Our amps...
What happened?
We had to like move...
It was so dry.
The neighbor upstairs complained. We practiced there twice, but that's when we fleshed out, as I recall... that's when we fleshed out Cut Up. We did a Cut Up style version of Distance Difference, where it was like a little bit like, half
time. We're a funk band now.
Yeah.
From.
We've been listening to a lot of Q&A.
From Light the End and Murder for people who have no clue.
What's funny is that I remember wanting Cut Up to sound like the Mars Volta, and it came out not sounding anything like that. And I was like, okay, that's probably for the best.
So we record, the reason that's not on the record, and I'll go ahead and just say this, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. We recorded the music was fine. Jay recorded his vocals. And he had recorded this sort of hot new melody for the chorus, which is, I thought it was boss. So I was like, I'm going to go ahead and do a new melody for the chorus too.
Which was previously just shouted.
Yeah, just shouted. Yeah. And so I recorded this thing that came out sounding like, it was like a Disturbed or like a Stained kind of thing. Like it was a real like kind of like mud grunge.
Like a
butt
rock.
And I was like, I think I've got it, guys. And I went down to the basement and recorded the vocals. We did a couple passes at it, and they're like, yeah, I think that's good. And like, I'm like from the basement to when I got to the top of the stairs, I was like, that's fucking terrible, right? Like, that's really bad. And they were like, yeah, it's pretty bad. So we're like, well, we got the other take. We'll just hold on to it, you know, for later. Because we only had 7 songs.
Oh, like,
here's a black car. Here's a white car.
Yeah.
It was so good.
Well, that did not go on the record.
Oh, I love it. I've still got that.
Yeah.
I've got it.
You hear that one day.
Sun locked and bolted, or still standing, left for dead, gone and forgotten. There's a black car, there's a show me the difference. There's a black car, there's a tell me the distance.
And we dropped that one, and then did we decide, okay, we need to write more songs? Is that how?
Yeah, there was a break. So
I don't know that it was.
I think maybe like we had one or two.
We totally did because it was in the summer, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then we did stuff here, and then
at Battle Tapes.
Yeah, yes. we were
summer of 05.
By this point, correct? We were practicing in the basement here at Battle Tapes.
Because I didn't live here anymore.
We were practicing here.
Yeah, I did live here still.
Yeah.
And then we recorded. We recorded all over that house. And then there was a little gap. And then we had those 3 other songs. And we're like, let's just go ahead and do it.
Yeah. And we were mixing the record. The record was like...
It was like,
how are we
going
to do this? But then was it Hartley's idea to just get a day at Alex the Great? Why did we do that?
I don't know why we did it, but we did it.
It was a great idea, though.
It was awesome.
But
it was cold when we did that, right?
It was
cold.
It was November.
I don't remember.
It was November.
Anything about the weather.
Being bleak.
But we just went in a day, didn't we? And
It was
2 days. I thought it was over 2 days. I thought we went there 2 days.
I think you went in and got sounds the first day, but I think
that's
exactly what it was.
That was a wonderful day.
Yeah,
I remember it.
Knocked out Walking the Plank, Plans, and Tennessee. We were like, yeah, these are going on the record.
And then I was like, oh my God, these sound great. We should just re-record the other songs here because it sounds so good.
Yep.
So then poor Jeremy had the task of trying to make a uniform sound across, you know, all the songs that were, 3 of which were recorded at a different place.
I don't think that I can't tell.
Well, that's awesome. I can.
Well, the thing that I can't do, but you know, the thing that worked to that advantage was that there were like three different drum sounds in mm-hmm. general.
Yeah.
So it's not
more
yeah.
interesting. Yeah.
Because we did like that wide open thing, and then we did like a real tape where we taped the
yeah super
tape the
shit
the
super dry ones,
and then the Alex the Great ones sound you know just
rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just did it like just live, single room. There's actually in plans is a take, isn't it? In plans where you can actually hear like you hit the one of the mics.
Yeah, I think
and, like, you
so.
Can, and, like we just we're like it's fine. We just
yeah.
Even the yeah. even that sounds good.
Yeah. Yep.
I like the bass sound of Battle Tapes better because we were just getting like scratch takes for bass at Alex the Great, and the idea was we were going to go back and overdub. We were going to try to get overdubs that night, and as soon as I plugged my amp into whatever bass cabinet they had there, just blew it out.
Oh, I remember that.
Just blew the 15, like the 15 was just yeah. shredded. And I felt so bad. I was like, dude, do I have to pay? Because, like, you know, Jeremy was working, I think, at Battle Tapes some, Jeremy Ferguson.
Don't point
at
me.
Was working at Alex the Great, you mean?
I mean, he did work there from time to time.
Yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
I was like, hey, send me a bill. I don't, you know, and he's like, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. It's part of, you know, they're prepared for this shit. Like, but yeah, so we just never overdubbed bass for those songs.
I like that bass sound.
That was all just like the live take in the studio.
Weren't you like just you were going through like a basement head or something like
that? Yeah, it was like a basement head and like a 112 cabinet.
Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah.
But it does sound different than you know, it sounded less like your live bass sound.
Did you guys have a feeling about the record as you were recording it?
I mean that was, you know, I was full on going for broke, you know. I was like, yeah, this is gonna be the record that makes us famous, guys.
Because it's obviously the same band from the first record, like the same style of music, but like everything's better.
Okay. No, I mean, well, I would agree with that.
I think the band's different. It's can we say more mature?
Maybe, yeah.
More
maybe
mature.
I should say
it's whether it's a better recording, better songwriters.
We were all better players. I was a much better singer by that point.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't even listen to myself.
I think the big thing is we were all when we first made the demonstration recording thing. I was like, this sounds great. This is the best thing we've ever done.
And it works.
In the history of all of us playing. Because we've all played together for so long. And then we did Life in a Bird 3. I was like, holy shit, this sounds phenomenal.
We recorded this with more than two microphones.
Yeah. This is the real deal. And then we did this one. Yeah, I thought it sounded great.
I thought it sounded really good. I was happy with the songs. And really whether it was like conscious or not, they're, you know, looking back, like, I mean, they are more songy than a lot of the stuff on Light the End of Burn It Through. Less math rock, less, you know, more songs.
It was the structure was probably a little
more pop.
Conventional.
Yeah, more pop. I mean,
and we've been playing together for an extended period of time at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was in 2005, I was like, I want to be a professional, you know, musician. Oh, yeah, I want to play music for a living.
I did.
Well, I mean, some of the best.
Yeah, let's go.
Some of your best songs are still on the first record. Like, I mean, those are great songs, but it just. It's different when you, I feel like if you listen to them back to back, it's a different thing.
I think it's, I mean,
you just sound like really confident.
We're definitely more confident.
Well, the thing that Hartley said, like when we were working on the first record and like, he was talking about this and he's like, this is my advice for every band I work with and we never do it. But like, he was like, my advice for any new band is like, write your first record and then just throw that record out. And the next 10 songs you write is your best stuff. Like that's your, you know, cause it's, that first record was, you know, there were leftover songs from other bands we had been in.
From, like, even 6 years before that.
Yeah.
Like, My Real Baby started off as a Shakedown Cruise song.
From 1998 or so.
Distance Difference was a School of Accuracy song, a band that Jay and I were in with Dylan Ross and Jeremy McCall.
And that never played a show.
We came across a poster where we had a show.
Apparently we had to book the show.
We had a show booked at Springwater opening up for Stuckit and Forget Cassettes at the Springwater in the spring of 2002.
But that never
happened. And we just realized that we didn't have our shit together enough to even play like three songs at a show. So
you started the band right after that then, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We actually broke up School of Accuracy to be in a follow-up. And then we ceded that name to Andrew and Jim when they were doing like a three-piece like hardcore.
Right,
John Robinson.
But yeah, for sure, like the Light the End and Burn It Through is more of us wearing our influences on our sleeves, I think, than, you know, I think we figured out what we wanted to sound like by the time we recorded Chariots of Fire.
Did you have any like sonic ideas going into the record? Because there's a lot of different instruments that you wouldn't normally find with that style of music.
Like you're talking about the horns and the percussion and stuff?
Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, that and in general, just how the record sounds.
Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, I had a better idea of how to record guitars by that point. Like, you know, how to get the sound I wanted.
I remember, and this may, I can't remember if this is when we were recording it or when we were mixing it and sequencing it, but we wanted the first side of that record to be like the front half of Scream, Dracula, Scream.
Yeah, I don't know if we talked about that, but I think we were all on the same page there.
Where we wanted it to be like, we wanted the sequence of songs to feel like falling down the stairs. Like it just keeps getting faster and
What's
faster.
The last song on the first side, I guess, because there was never a first side.
Yeah, Situation Hot's the last song on the first side.
Okay. Yeah, the first...
So we're just, you know, no gaps between songs, just pummeling you.
The first few songs are all totally relentless.
Yeah.
Before there's like a breath.
That's what we were
going
for sure. So I'm glad it came across that way.
But I remember that, like, specifically on Situation Hot, we had the chimes that we were thinking about Rock from the Crypt. Like, the... Is it Born in 69? The
Young Livers?
Young Livers, yeah.
Yeah.
Where it has the chimes.
The tubular bells.
Bing, yeah. Bong,
did Todd
bing.
Camp do this?
Yeah.
Yeah, he did play this.
That's invisible syllable there, right?
Yeah.
What did I say?
He said Situation Hot.
Sorry.
That's okay. I've been listening.
Yeah.
When we get to the list of songs, we can get all that.
Right, exactly.
You know, wheeled them down from Belmont, I guess. And, I mean, they were his own personal tubular bells that he owned, if anyone from the music department at Belmont listened to this. yeah, and that was awesome. It was cool to have him at our disposal. I also made him bring the congas, which he refused to play.
That's
so I played the conga part on that was on
Custom Critical.
Custom Critical, yeah.
QRS.
And then you play the horns on Cut Up. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Very mediocre horn section there, starring me, and me.
Yeah.
I did two tracks of trombone, which I felt pretty comfortable with, and then I played the trumpet, which I've always been kind of a hack at. I knew, and you know, it would just sound weird if it was just two trombones. That's not really a horn section. But to this day, I wish I had like gotten a real trumpet player to come in and play like the super high screaming octave above the one I played. And maybe, you know, is there a reason that you didn't play sax?
I just don't think that. I mean, I did on Walking Papers.
Right.
It just didn't.
We threw it down as an idea, and then
we talked
like,
about it
or something.
And then I think you're just like, just leave it as brass. Yeah.
So I mean, I think a big part of this record, like every part of the record after we tracked it initially, is like Jay was living at Battle Tapes. Like Jay lived here.
Right.
And
so that's true. I could just jump in and be like, hey, Jeremy, can I put a track down of something on this?
I was probably on summer vacation or pretty close to it, I guess. Because, like, we...
Yeah, you guys were at the studio a lot.
We totally experimented with pretty much everything, I think.
Also, I think, and you guys maybe know the timeline of my life better than I do. I was also playing for cassettes at this time. Yeah. And had I already recorded Salt? Did that come out? I can't remember if we...
Salt came out after...
Come out after? That's right.
Yeah, it did.
I think we were in the studio around the same time, and I had, like, sort of, you know, gotten more confident about, you know, overdubs and things. And
Was it possible that, like, we did the first songs of Battle Tapes, and then y'all went over to Alex the Great and did Salt?
I think that's how it happened.
And then we went back to
that's
Alex
right.
the Great.
I think- but yeah, so anyway, I had been spending more time in the studio in general, I guess, because of Forget Cassettes, and I was feeling pretty confident about... You know, trying crap like that, like putting horns on it or whatever.
We played around with the drums a lot. Like, we kind of read up on, you know, probably Queens of the Stone Age drum sound at that point about how they track all that. Maybe Marsville, but I think it's probably Queens of the Stone Age.
Which any record in particular?
Is that right? That can't be right.
Songs
it wasn't out that. It wasn't out that far ago, was it? Oh, anyway, but we did pretty much every song with a track of just wide open. Drums up in his bedroom, up in Jeremy's bedroom, and then
wet drums.
Then we went and just taped everything down.
And you did those in the dining room. Right?
Did those in the dining room? Taped them dead
to get the super dry.
Dead.
And what were you playing to?
I just do everything to click.
Yeah, a big difference between the first record and the second record is we did it.
I've refused. I was like, I'm not gonna do anything unless we play to click.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think we probably. Almost abused that to a certain extent because like we would play through a take and then be like, well, we can fix that.
Yeah.
You know, we can punch that up later because we had the click. So it was real easy to punch in and out with everything.
And do edits and can even if you have headphones on and you listen real carefully at the beginning of Walking the Plank, you can hear the click a little bit.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
sure.
Oh yeah.
When Jay's counting it off, you can hear the click through the headphones.
So, yeah, I think I heard that for the first time the other day.
But yeah, like I played to a click and
did he have a scratch guitar on? Were you just right?
Playing most of the time when you were tracking
just do it to click?
No, I think that y'all played guitar and drums to track it initially.
I think most of the songs that we did here at Battle Tapes, aside from the Alex the Great stuff, was scratch guitar and drums for the live drum take. And then we'd go back and overdub.
And then, so I'd do a full take with the open drums, full take with the taped down drums. And so if you listen, a lot of verses are the taped down drums.
And then the big drums get edited in for the chorus.
Choruses and nice. Stuff like that. So he bounced back and forth a lot.
Jeremy did also a lot of, Jeremy Ferguson did a lot of drum editing on the record in terms of he would take a particular snare hit from we also, I think, did we do that on purpose where we would just get hit individual hits?
We did straight hits on everything.
Individual hits.
You could
hits
overlap,
of each drum.
So you could kind of play some in. Yep.
Right.
And
future proofing in case there was a mix.
Well, they did
fun
stuff with the hi hats and stuff the compression on there.
Yeah.
And
I remember coming in.
It was cool.
When I was still living here at Battle Tapes, and I would come into the control room, and Jeremy had been editing, I don't remember which song it was, but he had done a thousand different drum edits on this one song, just putting individual hits underneath the snare that was there to make it sound thicker and all this stuff. He went crazy with it.
Yeah.
Gives me a headache.
Yeah, he's
awesome.
Put in so many fucking hours in the record.
So you guys have recorded it, you got a feeling about it, I'm sure, this is really badass.
I was really excited about it for sure.
Yeah, I have a thing where I as soon as we're done with the record I hate it. For 2 weeks. So
Mike Shepard, everybody.
This is when it was the EP. It was when the 8-song EP. So we had finished tracking it. Oh, the first track was a recording of a cicada. That we had taped on the
porch. You remember?
The
long...
It was
a
cicada.
Cicada?
Buzzing up and then buzzing back down because there was the cicada.
It's long.
I don't remember that at all.
Really? I think I still have that.
Yeah.
I don't remember that at all.
So we had finished it, we did the first pass at a mix, just a real rough mix, put it in the CD player in my car, drove, and I remember specifically I was in the drive-thru at Taco Bell, and I was listening, and I either called or texted Jay or Jim. I was I think we made a bad record. I think we blew it. We fucked up. We had to start over.
Was that before we did the Alex the Great stuff?
Yeah, for sure. But also,
that's when I really got jazzed about it.
Also, that's something that I've just had to learn about myself. Is I'm just gonna hate the record the first time I hear it after it's done, and I just have to ignore anything I think about it. Wait 2 weeks, and listen to it again because.
But I was totally riding the fucking Apollo Up hype machine by the time it came out.
Oh, dude!
Because I was we got distribution now through a subsidiary of Sony, guys.
Yes. We had distribution.
It was
in a roundabout way through Sony.
It was by far the biggest thing I had ever done musically. At that point,
I shudder to think probably about how annoying I was at the time. I was so excited about it for a little bit.
I was extremely jazzed.
And we had a song on Real World Road Rules Challenge.
Yes, we
did.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
Which song?
It was some web-only content.
No song? No, we had a on a proper broadcast episode.
There was a broadcast, and then there was a...
There was a scene where the teams were having...
There were two
things.
About a tractor.
They had to pull farm equipment out of a mud patch.
Yeah.
And they used the intro to No Song.
And they're pulling a tractor.
Yeah.
Any money from that?
Couple hundred bucks, I think, didn't we?
I don't remember getting paid for that.
We split it up, I thought.
We've gotten a couple of checks from ASCAP that we split.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
I'm not on the ASCAP.
That's what I'm talking about.
And there was an episode of the Real World Road Rules Challenge, after show, that was web only.
Yes,
web only. And they used cut up for the closing credits.
That's right.
I was voted most likely to be on MTV. So.
That's true.
Oh, you did it.
I did it, guys.
To this day.
Oh, right. Like, you didn't get it?
Ryan and Jeremy tied
for most likely to be on MTV. I got most dramatic.
For listeners at home, Mike and Jeremy went to high school together.
Yes. We've known each other for many, many years.
We missed our silver jubilee, but it's been 25 years this year.
Yeah. We're releasing that on vinyl. Our
friendship?
Entire friendship. Yeah. Picture disc of
10 record set.
Gotta scare up that future man.
Yeah, aren't we going to talk about it? How did you guys, or why did you decide to go with John Golden for the mastering?
Because we could afford him. for the first time? You it was afford to have like a legit, you know, respected master.
Was he what, like? Did you think about that when you were mixing it, or was it just like, hey, we know this guy's work and it's good, and we can pay for it?
I think it. I mean, it wasn't something that was on my mind at all while we were recording. But then when it came time to master, and I guess Hartley was like, hey, we can get John Golden to do it.
Yeah,
and I was like, fuck yes.
Like we're all kind of like liner notes nerds. So like, mm-hmm. not just listening to the record, but also like reading all the credits, seeing who produced it, who mixed it, who mastered it. Like, you know. Yeah. I always wanted to record a record with Steve Albini. I always wanted to have, and then I wanted to have a record mastered by John Golden. Like, it was just like a name I knew. So when Harley was like, we can get that, I'm like, let's do that, of course.
Yeah, and that was also the first, again, with this record, it was, you know, also the first time I think any of us had recorded anything that was like, you know, professionally mastered, you know, like by a real...
I mean, the first record Jim Domain did...
But I mean, like, I guess I'm, you know, and that's doing him a disservice when I say that, but, you know, I mean,
by someone in a different city.
Someone that we had heard of before we were looking for someone to master.
Yeah, so that was a big deal too, yeah.
Did you have the sequence ready when you mastered it? How did you guys sequence
that? I always make Mike do that.
I kind of agonized over sequencing.
And you didn't care?
I think I knew that I wanted Walk in the Plank to be the first track.
Yeah, we went back and forth a little bit, like...
Well, and that's also, like, playing out and stuff. I think we started to cultivate, sort of...
That's true.
You know, set lists and stuff like that, things that flow together, and things typically... Like, when we did live, we would do Walk in the Plank and Invisible Syllable pretty typically, you know. Like, it started to sort of...
Yeah.
Kind of organically...
Not to like interject myself here, but like you're playing it live that way, so you kind of think that's how it should be.
Yeah,
feels right in that order. Yeah,
and then you know, just kind of ebb and flow stuff through the rest of it. And when you play,
and you want to make sure it doesn't
be last, right? Like that was.
Well, how did you know that?
Well, okay, so when we did the EP, I know that Situation Hot was the last track on there, but I think most of the sequence was roughly the same. I think it opened with Invisible Syllable.
Yeah,
and then went into No Song. Cut Up, and then Even If You Don't Die, Custom Critical, and Job's a Game, and then Situation Hot last, I think.
Did we have the Distance Difference in there?
Distance Difference was in there somewhere.
Yeah.
For sure.
It was fourth.
Yeah, probably.
I seem to remember it being fourth.
So we had to kind of juggle everything when we got the new songs in, because like once we had Walking the Plank done, I was like, well, obviously this is the first song on the record. Like, that has to be the thing. And then... Plans in Tennessee, we wanted to finish with Plans because it had the big drop A.
You know, sustaining note, and we're like, well, how else can you end the record?
Yeah, right.
But now Mike wishes we had...
I do. I wish we had...
Flipped those two.
Because we always, when we played it live, we would go Plans into Tennessee, and it's like...
It's like the little, you know, exclamation point at the end of the set.
Yeah.
To do it that way.
And we just, when we tracked it, we split them up, and it just, like... At the time, I was like, yeah, of course we've got to finish with Plans. Of course Plans has to be the last song on the record. Like, that's obvious. And now I'm like, could've just swapped.
Could've been. Yeah, we could've swapped. But I'm cool. I like the way it is.
It's not like that on the first record where I'm, you know, I felt strongly at the time and I still feel strongly. But.
Yeah, of the placing of that song?
I didn't want it to be all distorted on the
record. Oh, yeah. And I was like, make it more distorted.
Yeah.
I had a vision for that. But, and it was like the beginning of that Mars Volta album, right? Like it started out kind of compressed and in a little box and then
drops in.
That
gets which was
huge.
The thing that everybody was doing in like the early
2000s. Exactly
what
I wanted to do.
Yeah,
I think that's what I wanted to do too. Right?
So it's all Jay's fault that there's nothing wrong with that song.
Yeah, the old telephone vocals, everything's
big.
Yeah.
Okay. See, you got the record back from mastering. Listen to it. You're like awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first one was a little blown out, right?
Did we send it back?
I feel like we did.
I think we might have.
I think it was super compressed when we got it.
I remember
back,
us so having notes.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit smashed when we got it back the first time. But, like, there wasn't much wrong with it. And then the second time was, like, perfect, according to us, I believe.
Yeah.
And we were like, let's get it out the door.
Did you have the artwork ready?
I don't remember at what point we started. So I did the cover, the art, and I don't remember how that even came about.
No. Well, we talked a lot and we met with Bryce McLeod.
That's right.
From Isle of Printing.
Who is now even more renowned.
Yeah, who was a mutual friend of ours. We had coffee with him. I loved his work. I thought that it would be really cool, Chariots of Fire. We had that name from very early on because we played a cover of Chariots of Fire.
That was the next question, yeah. Actually. So,
I don't remember if we talked about this when we decided to name it that, but like, I was always a big fan of how, because you cannot copyright a title, and right. The Dead Milkmen would always have a song with the same title as another very famous song, but it was a totally different song.
Right.
Like, they have a song called I Am the Walrus. It's a totally different song.
Yeah.
They had a few more like that.
Well, I mean, they had the record Metaphysical Graffiti, which is close to Physical Graffiti.
Well, the Replacements had Let It Be, which was...
I always thought that was fun, like, when bands would do that.
Well, Saw Our Standing There on the first record.
Like, right, yeah. I mean, I guess we had already done that once, yeah.
So Chariots of Fire, we had been playing just for money. We'd been playing at the Country Music Marathon. Mm-hmm. We paid like $300. We had to show up super early.
It was
fun. A lot of fun. But we were like, obviously, we got to cover Chariots of Fire.
Oh, yeah. So I should explain what that was about a little bit.
We had a really hot cover of Chariots of Fire. Like,
so we
super
had
fucking hot.
The situation that when you play at the Country Music Marathon, you set up on a stage by the road along the marathon.
They assign you to a mile marker.
Right.
And you set up and you show up at like 4:30 in the morning.
Was it like Wedgewood?
We were on Wedgewood. We were right out by Belmont.
The first year we did it, we were in the parking lot of the Charlotte Kroger.
Oh,
not Charlotte.
Not Charlotte.
Jefferson or whatever.
Yeah. Metro Center Boulevard Kroger.
But yeah, and so we were like, we have to play Chariots of Fire as the runners run by.
Because that one band totally bailed.
That's true.
We played forever.
For all you millennials out there, Chariots of Fire was a movie about running guys.
It was.
About Running Man. Not the running man challenge.
Not the dance.
Yeah, so that was just something we talked about, like Chariots of Fire, Apollo. Like, we never got too hung up on it, but we did talk about, like
the association.
Gold.
Yeah.
Apollo, Golden Chariot, like that whole,
that whole thing.
So Chariots of Fire we thought was a cool idea, and so we just kind of had that in the pocket when we started working on it, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever really belabor it much. I think it was just kind of there.
So for the artwork, we were talking to Bryce McLeod about it, and he does, like, at the time especially, he was doing, like...
Like linoleum prints.
Linoleum etchings, where he would, like, gouge out linoleum and then do prints with those.
And he had done a show poster for us already, hadn't he?
I think that was after that.
Okay.
So I was a big fan of there was this book of Greek mythology that I had when I was a kid. It was, like, this married French couple called, like, the Dallaires or something like that. And they had this sort of, like, colored pencil style drawings of Greek mythology, and I thought it'd be really cool to get Bryce to kind of knock that off in sort of a Apollo Chariots of Fire something. So we met with him a couple of times, did a couple of sketches. He came back with a quote, and by that point, I mean, to be frank, I think we just spent so much money on recording the record.
Yeah.
And
spent all the money.
Hartley was like,
he was like, don't you think maybe you, like, you didn't Jay do something before? Couldn't we just use that? And so, like, And so Jay had... I was
still working as a freelance graphic designer at that point, so, you know, I had the Photoshop ready to go.
Yeah, and I mean, we were just high on the, like, you know, we'll spend money on this, and Hartley's over here, like, you know, like, maxing out credit cards, trying to put the record out, and he's like...
Right, because y'all were like, this is the one, we gotta put it all in.
We were all in.
So, but I mean, you know, the cover's great.
Thanks.
Good job, Jay.
I like it. It's like one of the few things I designed that long ago I still like. And unfortunately for this reissue, we could not find the original design files, so Michael Eads did a really awesome job of...
I scanned them on my, like, flatbed printer in my office at home, and...
Yeah, and Eads
Michael
cleaned it all
it
up.
And blew it up.
Nice.
Yeah.
We're professional.
Yeah. All right, now...
to the notes.
Can we talk about the songs?
Yeah.
Sure.
Let's do it.
All right. Walking the Plank is the first song on the record. For me, like, I remember hearing it, and then it's kind of come to be regarded as, like, one of the best songs, like, from Nashville rock.
Well, you know? According to the NashvilleCream.com.
Okay.
I mean, I've talked...
I agree, Ryan.
Fuck you.
I mean, that's cool.
You guys can disagree.
No, I do agree. I like that song.
It's great. No, it's...
It's just because it's the... I mean, if it was in the middle of the album, maybe it wouldn't be that way. But you guys open with it, and it's the first song.
It's the kick in the door. Like,
Any particular things about that song that you remember writing? Or
one thing I remember about the writing playing? Of that is that the initial soft, loud, those two chords that go back and forth. I remember hearing a private song that did something like that, and I thought it was really cool. So that was what was in my mind when that thing came into my head. So I ripped off the Privates for that, yeah.
They'll be expecting some.
I didn't know.
Nashville's the Privates.
Cut that out.
All right, they're going to come out for all that money we made.
Disregard
that,
Dave.
I don't remember writing that song at all.
I remember coming out with those two chords, and that's all I remember, really.
I remember when we recorded it, because I still laugh, even to this day, when I listen to it. You know, they've got like the little fills the second time through the breakdown.
You mean the book in the back of the book in the back of the
stuff? Yeah. So those were challenging for me at the time, and I got through the snare one, and then I did the tom one, and I can't remember what I was supposed to play. But if you listen to it, that what is on the actual song right now is total gibberish.
Yeah.
Is me completely fucking up. Like completely just like just
but it's awesome because you come down on that next one and it's fine, so it's
totally
like you did it on purpose.
And so I listened to it and I came up and I was like, I fucked it up, guys. Like that's totally not a keeper. Like I just it was all good except for that one thing. I really fucked up. And I listened to it and I was like, oh shit. It's kind of in time. Nobody's gonna know.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's
and it's supposed to be frenetic anyway.
Oh yeah. It's me.
You can
just
tell, yeah, you can tell that,
that
you're
not
going
even
for it.
Yeah, I'm totally
going for it. I miss it. I missed it.
But you strove. But
then you snatched it back.
But then we just went with it.
And I wish I had a cool story about the the guitar part. I don't remember. I think it just kind of happened while we were jamming out on that chord progression.
So a lot of that stuff we were writing at Battle Tapes and like
in the basement. I remember us practicing that song in the basement.
Yeah. And just kind of jamming stuff out. Which like I hate the word jamming. I don't like jamming, but like
boy, Mike does not like.
Yeah.
Mike does not like jamming. We don't jam behind the curtain.
We jam with
Mike's
a purpose, which is to come up with songs and not
and like
just
and
to,
that my yeah. process is to see what the song is and then write a part to it. So
yeah.
like for me,
yeah.
jamming is just like
wasting time.
Also, I also remember. And we may have talked about this, but this is around the time that people had ringtones on their phone.
Yeah.
And I was like, that guitar part would be an awesome ringtone, man. I hope.
I think
like,
it was a ringtone for them.
I think I might have made it into my own ringtone.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Like the beginning, like the intro?
Just the...
Yeah, I think that was a ringtone for several
people. I just remember being really excited about that song. It came together.
Yeah, it was cool.
It came together pretty effortlessly, I guess, because we don't remember... I don't seem to remember laboring over it too much.
Like, and I like watching the videos because I had to watch a bunch of videos to cut together the promo that we did for this record.
Mm-hmm.
We were playing that song the first time we went to CMJ.
Yeah, it's a good thing somebody took a lot of videos of us.
Spring of 2004? 2005?
Oh, wow, really? Okay.
No, it must have been winter. When did we go to... Because we went to CMJ.
So did we not...
We went
to
CMJ.
So
it
was 2005 and 2006.
Yes, yeah.
So it was fall of 2005. So we
September,
were,
I think.
So it was probably
September 24th and 25th.
Let's make sure we get these dates right, guys.
You know what? I'm gonna look it up.
It was before we recorded, like, and the parts were different.
Down.
The parts
like,
were different.
Yeah, that's true. It did go through some evolution.
Playing it live, and that's another thing.
Clay Thompson
up in here. I believe sincerely that playing a song live is kind of important to working it out. Like, I don't like to record a song before it's been played live because I don't think you really know how it goes.
Right.
Until you put,
yeah.
you know, like got it out of rehearsal. So
especially if you're, you know, yeah, like as a band, you're gonna iron some things out live that wouldn't get ironed out.
So like,
which remember that when we get down to one of these songs, like,
well, there's nine right. more left.
So one last thing about that song is the post chorus breakdown thing was like, and again, I don't know how conscious this was or how much it was like us realizing after the fact, but like. We all three of us love the B-52s, and especially that first B-52s record.
Yes, yes.
And
first
like
two.
That,
I like
that. That part is totally just like
that was very much an homage to that whole record. Really, that,
it
that
really was.
That guitar player whose name I can't think of right now. Anyway, yeah, no, for real. Like that guy was a huge influence on me before I even realized it. You know, like his guitar playing was a big influence on me. So the original, you know, Skronk. Rock guitar player.
Other than Arnold Lindsay.
Probably. Yeah. Well, yeah, Skronk, I'm sorry, Skronk actually is a genre. So, but yeah, that, you know, just spanking those single strings on those lower notes, that stuff is really cool.
Okay. Invisible Syllable.
So I remember that as being the first song we wrote after the songs that are on.
That's entirely possible.
Like I feel like that's right.
And
I'm pretty fired up about that song.
We wrote it at the house on Dozier. What I recall...
Was that the last song we wrote in Dozier?
It might be. No, Cut Up. We'd worked on Cut Up
at Dozier. I remember working on Cut Up at Dozier, yeah.
I don't know if we had it ready to go when we recorded Light the End and had just decided not to include it.
Maybe so.
Because there are a couple of songs that we cut.
There were like two that I think we
Dirty
did not
Switch
record.
And
which
the one,
never got recorded.
And the fuck is Dirty Switch?
It was the one where we had the...
We actually played it live a couple times.
No,
It had that... Yeah, it had that chromatic
and the bridge was the chorus from Come the Fuck On by the Shakedown Cruise, where it was like...
Oh, yeah, it had the place in France where the Naked Ladies dance. We tried it. I remember we played it live more than once, and afterwards
I can't think of how that song goes at all.
Yeah.
And then also the other song that nobody ever heard that we actually recorded and put on a record that nobody could get to. What was the one on the beginning of Light the End?
Oh, Roken and Zerdlick.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because we thought, surely somebody will rewind the first track on their CD player and for 3 minutes and find this hidden track.
But you got to time it out just to the beginning of the song.
Yeah, right.
Because then
it was really difficult to do. To this day, I don't even have a copy of that MP3 because you can't get it off the CD.
I can't.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I played guitar on that.
But that was back when people were doing all those tricky things with hidden tracks.
Or like maximizing the potential of the CD format.
The negative track.
Or like,
but we couldn't but we did it one step further where you can't access it.
So anyways, we had written that song. We had kind of thrown it out. We hadn't really worked on it for a while. And then we kind of came back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think we pounded it out. It was good.
Yeah. We just went back to it and like...
And then when we were...
We're talking about Invisible Silver right now?
Yeah.
Still, yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that was the one. I had been listening to
put that little harpsichord on there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've been listening to a lot of Ennio Morricone, and I was totally obsessed with spaghetti Western music, and I wanted to make it sound, I wanted to add some of those layers in. So that's why we did the tubular bells, and I added a little harpsichord part that you can barely hear on the original... Mm-hmm. Version on the remastered version, it pops out nicely.
Yeah, I only heard the original version from listening to it on headphones.
Okay, yeah.
Then I noticed it.
Yeah, which was kind of like...
Never heard it before.
It was a lot of like... And this will sound great on headphones. Like, maybe if somebody puts on headphones, they'll listen to it. They'll hear this part, like...
And it was there for just kind of color. Like, we didn't want it to be too out front. Yeah. But it comes out in a nice way on the remastered version.
I had a lyric on the outro that we... I think I volunteered to cut out.
Oh, that's right. It was a shouted vocal part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The something's been defeated.
The
something's in my thing.
The past, it was a lot of energy.
The past has been repeated?
I
also don't know the lyrics to any of our songs, by the way.
The code has been repeated until all meaning was lost.
Oh, right.
The password has been defeated. You'd best
forget about it. The password has been defeated.
Also, fun fact, that song, the lyrics are about when I lived here at Battle Tapes and I had my first cell phone, and I had to go outside to talk on the phone. Couldn't talk on my phone in the inside of the house because I couldn't get signal. So it's just a song about how I couldn't get good cell service.
Nice.
Yeah. The house that we're at right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No song. What's that about?
A girl.
Is there a particular song that... song?
I guess it was just like the idea that I don't know. I guess I was being disdainful of love songs in general or something. Mostly just the words had the right number of syllables.
Gotcha.
Sounded good.
A lot of it was like we would play a song. Like lyrics always came after the song for us. So we'd work out the music and Jay would usually have just like some filler
Like hot chicken,
for example.
It actually took us a long time. Well, when we get to that one, yeah. We'll talk about that.
So like we'd have filler lyrics, and then sometimes they get replaced, and sometimes they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So I think on that song, like the chorus is just like, no song is ever that long. You've got the lyrics all wrong. And,
yeah.
And then it like, you know, there were, I'm assuming, shades of which that like kind of informed the direction the rest of the lyrics went. Mm-hmm. Slash.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't remember too much about the writing of that song, the music of it, but I do remember sitting on the couch here at Battle Tapes. And coming out with that riff, that main opening riff on an acoustic guitar. That's all I remember.
I bet that sounded great on an acoustic guitar.
Well, just the bing near stuff. That sounded pretty cool. Like,
but I bet like the big
the strummy beef.
Yeah,
pastrami beef.
Tied for my
big pastrami
favorite song to play.
Yeah.
It's a fun song to play
with.
Heartbreak of Victory.
Oh yeah, that one's fun too.
Off of Walking.
But the thing
but just
about,
for me personally,
the thing about no song is that it's there's a whole lot going on in that intro, and yeah. If one of us bones up that intro, then it's done.
We're done.
We have to stop the song.
It basically folds.
How many times did you hit start it over?
Nope.
I don't think we ever really did that.
But I think mostly it was just a fear of mine that I was always going to bone up that guitar part.
It's pretty easy for me. That part's easy for me. The other stuff, it's kind of a busy, stupid drum part. But it looks flashy, so what are you gonna do?
It looks flashy.
It looks
good when I'm playing though.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's...
All right.
Oh, and then also, I really... it ends with the James Bond chord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we argued over
there
that
was,
a little bit.
There was a little bit of tension.
I thought it would be great. I thought it would be great to close the song...
Just ended on that.
Tension.
Unresolved.
Like you have just go into the next song.
And I was like, but I want to play the James Bond chord.
Yeah.
There's tension in that chord though.
Yeah.
There is.
Are you bitter?
That's one thing that I would say that I want to go on record as saying I don't give a shit at this point. I think it's fine.
Which means it's like saying,
you know, it's you know, do you wish you had changed this thing you did 10 years ago?
Right.
Like,
right.
There are things that
I said, we're about to get to one that I wish I had changed.
There's things that I wish I had done differently 10 years ago. And there's things that I could have done differently 10 years ago, but I don't really give a shit at this point. And that's one where I'm just like...
And I still like it, so I win. Took 10 years.
Why I do think that last little tag is good, because it's kind of the end of the first three song little chunk, which all three of those kind of flow together, and it separates Cut Up. And,
So Cut Up
Custom Girl
was definitely... informed by the sort of disco punk thing that was happening around that time, I guess.
We were listening to a lot of Mars Volta.
But then also, you know, we had already been listening to that kind of stuff, but like your Gang of Four is, you know.
I read in a review that we were part of the post-punk revival.
It says that in our Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember wanting it to be real dancey. I wanted to write a dancey song.
So Cut Up, lyrically, originally was a song that I sang and I wrote the lyrics, and it was a song about how I didn't like to shave.
Yeah.
His face.
It's so good.
And it was literally a song about how I didn't like to shave. You've got your right hand right on the blade, man.
Yeah.
It's at your throat again. Ritual learned at your father's knee. The chorus was blade slave.
Yeah.
The part where
it went blade slave.
Yeah.
Blade Slave. The song might have even been called Blade Slave at a certain point.
I think we kind of all realized, okay, this is ridiculous.
Well, what happened, the process that it went through was...
Time out.
Yeah.
Let me just say this. I'm not a lyrically motivated guy. I'm much more about the music and stuff like that. But I think when Mike brought in those lyrics, I was like... Oh yeah.
Yeah.
This is the shit. Like these are the best lyrics.
Oh, for real?
I think so. I think I remember.
The chorus.
I'm probably not Blade Slave, but
I mean,
everything else.
I don't remember having especially a problem with them initially.
So here's where the problem came in. Like when I was singing the song, it was fine. However, I was having trouble just as a musician playing my part and singing those lyrics at the same time.
That's right.
So then I was like, Jay, if you could sing on that, I'll be able to play well and everything will be fine. And then Jay...
And then I was like, I can't sing these
And like Jay doesn't, if I may speak for Jay for a moment, Jay has never done real well with singing lyrics that he didn't write. As far as like
I've always had
feeling comfortable with them.
I can't sell it.
Remembering them.
Yeah, well, especially remember them.
Caring about them.
So, but like, so, like, putting on to Jay, like, a song about the burden of shaving.
And yeah, I don't even have the, like,
I ain't even got whiskers.
If you guys out there listening know me at all, you know that facial hair is not a problem that I have.
So
it was hard for me to sell being angry about having to shave
the lyrics. Auto excoriation, you're all cut up and it's bringing you down. One urgent exhortation, throw out your blade now.
I had a hard time delivering those sincerely. Right.
So I think Snot just came out of my nose and went back in.
So like when we track the record, like it literally was down to, and I remember this vividly. It was, I like came to get Jay. I was like, it's time to record the vocals. And he was like with a notebook, just like, and we had to work out, like we basically hashed out like a mixture.
That was, maybe the first time we like collaborated on lyrics. Maybe.
Like we had written like parts separately, but like.
Yeah.
We ruining this record for everybody right now. Is anything?
Not for me. All
right, sweet. All right. Great. Excellent.
We sat down basically with my lyrics that I had written and the new lyrics that Jay had written and kind of like it's like, okay, this
which mine
here,
are not about any
part here, and it kind of became a song about,
it's just kind of about being oblivious to the world around you or something. I don't know,
the way I interpreted it was basically we're like a team of like, we're like the Thunderbirds, but like,
oh,
but we're on the lookout, we're on the lookout for people who are disconnected or isolated because of technology. Because, like, it was like...
Okay, like, sort of like a Devo thing. Like
sort of, yeah, for patrol. Sure. For sure. Like, we're still looking for your frequency. Like, that whole, like, you know, like...
Okay.
We're trying to come save you. Like, you feel disconnected, but we're coming for you.
I never knew that. Like, oh, that makes me like it a lot more.
Yeah.
Oh, now we'll play it. Now we'll maybe play it live.
Yeah.
Now it's also about...
Oh, and, yeah, and I have historically resisted playing this song live most of the time.
Because you didn't have horns or just...
But maybe part of it, but also I just felt like I might have taken, there was a review of the record that like bagged on that song a little bit, and I might have kind of internalized that a little bit, and I just like, oh, this song's dumb.
It was funky?
It was I think in the review it was called like a limp funk pastiche. And I was like, man, it's kind of...
Nobody has cared enough about us to write to even come up with that.
No, I remember reading that.
I remember reading
that. No. Song,
for sure.
What? And I was like, he's really... It's limp. It's a limp pastiche.
Oh
guys.
My god!
But like I remember, like that was one. That was a song where like, you know, like Jay brought in the verse and the chorus, and then like we wrote the bridge and like everything like together. Like, and that was kind of the process for a lot of the stuff. Was like Jay would bring in an idea for a verse or for a verse and a chorus, and then we would just kind of like hash out.
Mike and I were kind of arrangers.
Yeah,
take parts and plug them in pretty well.
Because Jeremy, you know, we've been
editing.
Even at this point, Jeremy and I have been playing together for 10 years. So like. We kind of knew.
I definitely depended on Mike and Jeremy to help me out with that. Because I've always been bad at that part of it.
You're like,
as you can see from when I made my record, it took me almost 3 years to put those songs together.
You say, we should play this part 30 times, and then they say.
Like 29. Full disclosure process would be like, he would have, you know, two or three parts, like, I just all laid out.
I was always bad about making that decision. Like, okay,
but
so we do 4, 8, 6, whatever.
You know. I felt like Mike and I were pretty good about, like, okay, we can do this. Let's cut this, you know.
Yeah.
Let's cut this in half. Put this here. Bridge here. Whatever.
Jeremy's really good at saying, why don't we play this? Why don't we drop a beat here? Like, Jeremy's thinking outside the 4-4 box a lot in terms of arrangement.
The 4-4 box.
4-4 box.
4-4 box.
Situation hot and ready.
Yeah, situation hot and ready. So that is one.
Whoa. Time out. One more thing.
Were we not done with Cut Up?
No, we're not done with Cut Up. Because another wonderful byproduct of our recording sessions here at Old Battle Tapes, there is a vocal track of Jay.
Wait, what?
Just printing it up on
those mixes.
Yeah.
And it is, I think I still have one.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's why I felt limp to that guy, because it didn't have my Prince vocals.
Dude.
A lot of falsetto.
It is so...
And I, like...
It is the best.
That
it
might
is,
have been the beginning.
It is the best thing ever. No. This play, I was like, man, we're just playing. It's not even
going
on. But that was another thing. It's like in the recording process, like someone would do something in the booth and I'd be like, that doesn't go on the record. And it's like, we're just fucking around. And then I would be like, okay, I'll fuck around too. And then I'd do it. And then it would be in the mix until like.
Yeah. Jeremy Jeremy loved to fuck with, especially Mike on the talkback. Whenever Mike went down to the vocals. Well, Jeremy's really into fucking with everybody on the talkback mic anyway. I think still, probably. But yeah, like for example.
It's part of his charm.
In, it's at the end of Tennessee. We'll talk about it when we get to Tennessee.
Yeah, if you listen through this record, there are, if you turn it up and put some headphones on, there's probably like a whole other record going on underneath.
Yeah, there's some Jeremy and some mic that I can hear.
Yeah.
But yeah. He was great about keeping shit at the end.
He would scream at you through the talkback mic and your headphones and stuff, yeah.
The best.
Yeah, to the extent that actually when we were working on the most recent record being the Tower Defense record that Jeremy and I did, the Stay Inside, there was some
did you just plug?
Yeah.
No, out on iTunes.
This is just for Ryan.
I don't want K records.
There were some mixes where I was like fucking around with something on vocals and I was like, could you please take that out because I can't listen to the record. Like, I can't hear the rest of the mix, because that's so distracting to me, like, the me fucking around in that, so, yeah. Anyway.
Do you have anything you would like to plug?
Got any,
side business?
You know,
any, concerts? Any Father Ryan concerts? You
know, yeah, I'm not going to plug this. I don't want people to come to this. Do not come to anything that I'm ever at, or my house.
All right, are we good with cut up?
Yeah, let's move on.
Yeah.
But Situation that top.
Yeah, so... What I remember about this is that I think it was me, came in with the chorus guitar part, the blah-na-na-na, blah-na-na, blah-na-na part, the rhythm and those chords, and I had that vocal rhythm. Bah-bah-bah-bah. And then I was just singing the words, hot chicken hot, because it had the right number of syllables.
Yeah, placeholders, yeah.
And we nearly went insane trying to think of something else that fit in that spot, and I could not stop myself from singing Hot Chicken Hot. Couldn't think of anything that fit in there. And then Mike, who is a big fan of Egyptian Lover.
Arabian Prince. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
I'm sure that Egyptian Lover's done a lot of great work, but Arabian Prince was, yeah.
Arabian Prince.
Well, Egyptian Lover is a record by him?
No, or Egyptian Lover is a different electro
That's right, different guy.
Artist influence.
Arabian
by,
Prince, yeah. not Egyptian Lover. He had a song called Situation Hot.
He had a record called Situation Hot.
And it goes, Situation, Situation Hot.
Hey, hey.
Situation.
No, that's too legit that I'm thinking.
Yeah. Anyway, it was that rhythm. And Mike was like, what about these words? And I had already heard some Arabian Prince from Mike playing it for me in the car, and we liked that phrase. We liked how it sounded. It had the right number of syllables. Sounded
like
cool.
Situation hot.
So we just plugged that in there. And that plays into the whole thing of like stealing song titles. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was perfect.
I was super excited about having a song called Situation Hot. But lyrically, that is my favorite. Up until very recently, that's my favorite set of lyrics that Jay has ever written.
Well, thank you, Mike.
I love the lyrics to that song.
Is it about anything in particular?
It's about, more or less, so that was around the time that the Ackland House party scene was going strong. For y'all that ain't know, there was a big Victorian house on Ackland Avenue here in Nashville.
Still there.
It's still there, but it's been bought and remodeled, and someone, like a family, lives in it now. But at the time, it was...
probably haunted every night.
A bunch of our friends lived in it. So there's like a bunch of 20-somethings living in this big house, and they would just have giant parties there every weekend, all inside the house, in the front yard, in the backyard.
There was a church parking lot directly adjacent, so it was like...
That's your parking.
Plenty of parking.
So that was what we did, like, I mean, at least me for, you know, probably almost 3 years, like almost every Friday night after work, we'd go and just party at Ackland House, and it was really fun. And anyways, yeah, so that song is kind of about, like, getting... starting to feel a little bit older and disillusioned with going to parties, basically, inspired by that whole scene. And there's some specific like phrases in there that like refer to things that happened at Ackman House.
Hmm. Evocative.
Yeah.
Scandalous.
Mm.
That's one of my faves.
That's one of my favorites on the record sonically because, like, okay, so when we were recording the record...
Oh, you did some shit with your bass. You used,
when we recorded the record, so like already...
You did,
oh, yeah,
you
that was a really cool thing.
I had just bought maybe like a year or two before a brand new, like my first new music equipment, anything. Bought a brand new Gallium Kruger 400 RB amp that I still have, and a brand new Ampeg HLF Rockback 410, which I still have.
Yeah.
I schlepped that 75-pound cabinet down the stairs of Battle Tapes. We set it up downstairs. Jeremy went downstairs while I just fucked around upstairs. Jeremy Ferguson went down and dialed it in. And got this sound. Where, like, and this is the thing that I've learned, like, the two best bass sounds that I've ever gotten on any record were on this record and on the Gentleman Divers record. Where the secret is...
Gentleman Divers was another band that I was not in.
The secret is you take...
I was in it. Because me and Mike are in all the
You take really good bass equipment and you turn it up way too loud. So yeah. It's just like blowing the fuck out. Like it sounds insane. So like,
and it sounded like literally like a 747. Like
it sounded flying out like of a Black Hawk hovering over the house. It was nuts. So the whole record, all the stuff that's not the first song or the last two songs recorded with that bass sound, which I fucking love. And then this like this Big Muff pedal.
Yeah, but there was something else with it,
all
right? There was
an octave. All
just
on
that song. Just during the guitar solo.
Just during the guitar solo, I was playing a fuzz channel, the regular part that I played. I was playing a clean channel with the regular part that I played. And then I was playing the fuzz channel an octave up. So there's three bass parts stacked on
there. Yeah, you had the
octave spread in the mix. Because that was something that we, I think, was that we consciously, or at least that I consciously thought about after the first record was... I don't want to have rhythm guitar parts behind my guitar solos on this record because then it doesn't sound like a three-piece anymore. It doesn't sound like a live... Like, you know, if I played a solo live, there wouldn't be a rhythm guitar part behind it.
Right.
So I really wanted to play the solo with no rhythm guitar part under it. And so that freed up all this space for Mike to do something cool
beef
there.
Beef up whatever.
Yeah. So like, and that was like...
It's a long guitar solo.
It is. And for that particular song, it was just like... And so recording... I remember recording that with that fuzz, playing that... There's a lot of like big spread parts on that, and just feeling the fucking house shake because like the tracking room,
yeah, it was big,
right above the basement, so you could feel it through the floor.
It was awesome.
It was insane, and it felt so good, and it sounds so good on
the
record.
And that's like there's some good math in there. That's, you know,
yeah.
Oh yeah, that again, was definitely like we would hash out little fun. You know,
little
counting,
math loops,
counting things
like the drum parts in a couple of places just sort of float over the bar line, and then it all lines
like
up
patterns of four
end.
Over
yeah.
three and
yeah,
three
yeah,
over four
yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Like I can't imagine writing a song like that now. Honestly, like you know, with all
I have
this.
No idea how we wrote these songs. Like,
right.
I don't know.
I really don't either.
I don't know.
End of podcast.
No, that's when you say, I don't know why we wrote these songs.
Yeah.
Fuck this shit.
That's true. But yeah, no, I really don't like. I mean, yeah, we would just hash these things out. I can't imagine doing that now, honestly. I can't imagine, like...
Yeah, am I too lazy to play any sort of mathy
maybe
rhythms
my,
anymore?
I think that my... I mean,
it's like, two
me,
and
like,
four is fine.
Yeah,
I'll just play into it real
well,
hard.
I mean, the last math thing you did was in Camelback, so, like, maybe that puts
you're
you
still
off.
Doing mathy stuff sometimes, right?
And then you put it on a click.
You're just playing the blues.
172,
well,
yeah. Two
well, also
and four.
For me, like,
straight down.
How long is that song? It's like over...
It's 5.5 minutes.
I can't imagine.
Is it 5.5 minutes?
It's long as fuck.
Five and a half minutes?
But it's a journey, man. Like,
it does a lot of stuff.
Do you have times on there? There's
no
way.
I don't have time.
It's like,
you are full of shit.
It's
all of y'all.
That record is only 36 minutes. And
well, then that takes up like a tenth of the, or
that's
a 17th, or a,
it's like,
that's like the middle.
It's like luau. Like, you know,
yeah.
Luau on Yank Crime is 9 minutes
luau,
long.
Right.
Like, it
yeah,
doesn't feel
it's
like
a fucking great
but
song.
But it doesn't
yeah.
feel like 9 minutes.
No, I'm not saying it.
Okay, right. Situation Hot. Anybody else?
I think
anything else?
The piano part at the beginning was
oh, yeah.
a cool little thing.
That was a little thing because Jeremy had, I think, recently acquired a little spinet piano here
yeah.
at Battle Tapes back then, and I just heard that thing in my head. And
it was a little guy, right?
Either.
You did it on the little dude?
No, it was a full-size spinet. So Jeremy had gotten that, I think it was actually from somebody that lived on the street on Greenland, who was just giving it away. That part might be inaccurate. But anyway, we got it to the house.
Quick story about this. Yeah. So he got it from this dude.
Quick false story.
I mean, I don't know if that's true, but the other part is...
No, no, that's not the story. That was the setup. Anyway,
fake news about this record.
Yeah. But anyways, the real thing that happened was he tried to get the piano tuned, and the harp part of the piano that actually holds the strings at the bottom was cracked, and so it would not hold enough tension to get all the strings in tune. So the guy said, how about this? I can get it in tune with itself, but the whole thing will be a step down.
Yes.
So when you hit a C on that piano, it was actually a D. I mean, an E. And what comes before C? A B. When you hit a C on that piano, it was actually a B.
Flat.
So
Is it a full step down?
I think it was a full step down.
B-flat?
B-flat then, yeah. So,
I'm a nerd.
I'm super knowledgeable about music theory. And anyways, yeah, so I had to like transpose that part to a different key to make it fit with the song. The end.
Cool.
Okay, that's it for part one. Thanks for listening, and keep an eye on We Own This Town for part two, where the second half of the record is discussed, as well as the release of the record. Thanks.